Welcome back, everybody, to another deep dive. This time, we're going to be talking about a case from 1982, a New York Court of Appeals case called People v. Fuller.
People v. Fuller? Well,
that's interesting.
I know what you're thinking. 1982 restitution.
Yeah.
Sounds riveting, but stick with us.
Right.
Because this case is actually way more interesting than it might seem at first glance.
Yeah, what's fascinating about People v. Fuller is that it was the first case in New York to really grapple with how restitution works in criminal sentencing.
Okay.
And it established some really crucial boundaries between what judges can do and what probation departments can do.
So let's set the scene.
Right.
This case involves Patricia Fuller, who was convicted of grand larceny for concealing employment in order to receive extra welfare benefits.
Right.
She ended up receiving just under $6,000 between 1973 and 1975.
And you might think this is a pretty straightforward welfare fraud case, but here's where it gets interesting.
Yeah.
Social services discovered the fraud in 1975.
But Fuller wasn't actually arrested until 1977.
A two-year delay. Why such a long gap between discovery and arrest?
That's a great question, and it gets to the heart of one of the big legal issues in this case.
Okay.
The concept of due process and whether the delay violated Fuller's rights.
Right.
But before we dive into that, let's talk about what happened after her arrest.
So she pleads guilty.
Right. So she was sentenced to 5 years of probation.
Okay.
And ordered to pay restitution, but the judge didn't actually specify the exact amount of restitution, leaving it up to the probation department to figure out.
So the judge basically just handed it off. That seems a little unusual, doesn't it?
It was definitely unusual, and it sparked a major legal debate.
Yeah.
The probation department ended up ordering Fuller to pay over $7,600 in restitution.
Wow.
A figure that included not only the benefits she received illegally, but also benefits she received after the crime was committed.
Wait, hold on a second.
Right.
How can they make her pay back benefits she received after the crime was already done?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem right.
That's exactly what the Court of Appeals grappled with.
Mm.
They had to decide, can courts delegate the authority to set restitution amounts to the probation department?
Hmm.
To figure that out, they turned to the relevant statute, Penal Law, Section 60.27.
And what did that statute say?
The statute makes it crystal clear that the authority to determine restitution rests solely with the court, not with the probation department in their decision. The Court of Appeals even emphasized that the court alone must set the amount and methods of restitution.
Wow.
They were sending a strong message about who holds the power in these situations.
So probation departments can't just freelance and come up with their own restitution figures.
Exactly.
They have to follow the court's orders.
Think of it this way. The judge is the architect, and the probation department is the contractor.
Okay.
The contractor carries out the plan, but they can't just redesign the house however they want.
Yeah.
The court's decision in People v. Fuller really cemented that principle.
That's a great analogy.
Thanks.
So that covers the restitution issue.
Uh-huh.
But we still have that lingering question about the two-year delay between the discovery of the fraud and Fuller's arrest.
Right. And that brings us to the second major legal question in this case.
Okay.
Did that 21-month delay violate Fuller's due process rights?
That seems like a really tricky area.
Yeah.
How do courts even go about figuring out if a delay is a violation?
Well, in this case, the Court of Appeals used a four-part test to analyze the delay.
Right.
First, they looked at the length of the delay itself, which was 21 months.
21 months. Okay. What else?
They also looked at the statutory limit for prosecuting this type of crime. In this instance, it was a Class D felony, which had a maximum sentence of 5 years.
So the delay was well within the statutory limit. Does that mean it was automatically okay?
Not necessarily.
Oh.
The court also considered the reasons for the delay. 12 months of that delay were attributable to social services taking their time to report the fraud to the prosecutor's office.
Interesting. So they weren't letting the prosecutor off the hook entirely?
Right.
What was the final factor they considered?
The fourth and perhaps most crucial part of the test was whether Fuller could demonstrate any actual prejudice.
Okay.
Or harm caused by the delay.
So did she present evidence that the delay hurt her case?
That's where things get a bit nuanced.
Okay.
The court concluded that in this particular case, there wasn't enough evidence to prove she was prejudiced by the delay, but they left the door open for future cases.
Okay.
Suggesting that even a delay within the statutory limit could be problematic if it negatively impacted the defendant.
So they were sending a message, Just because you're within the time limit.
Exactly.
Doesn't mean you can just sit on a case.
The court was acknowledging that delays can have real consequences, even if they don't technically violate a statute of limitations.
That makes sense. But this case also had another interesting wrinkle, right?
Right.
Something about the court addressing the restitution issue, even though Fuller didn't object to it during her sentencing.
You're right. That was an unusual aspect of this case. The court decided to review the restitution issue, even though it wasn't technically raised by Fuller.
Why would they do that if she didn't object? Wouldn't that normally mean she accepted the terms?
Typically, yes. But the court in this case emphasized that the right to a lawful sentence is a fundamental right. And because of that, appellate courts have the power to review sentencing decisions, even if the defendant didn't raise specific objections during the original proceedings.
So it's kind of like a safety net.
Exactly.
Ensuring that even if a defendant misses something or doesn't understand their rights, the court will still step in to make sure the sentence is lawful.
It's a powerful protection for defendants, and it highlights the importance of appellate review in our legal system.
This is already so much more interesting than I expected. I'm starting to see why this seemingly mundane case ended up having such a big impact.
It really does show how a single case can illuminate so much about the complexities of our legal system, and the rulings in Huma-Fuller are still shaping how these issues are handled today.
Okay, so we've got the restitution issue, the due process issue, and this unusual twist with the appellate review. I'm sure you're thinking, all right, what does this all mean for me?
Let's get to the takeaways for lawyers and anyone studying law.
Yeah,
One of the biggest takeaways from Beeple v. Fuller is that judges can't just delegate the responsibility of determining restitution. They have to be the ones setting the amount. And the payment plan probation departments play an important role in administering those terms. But the core decision-making authority belongs to the judge.
It's like the judge is laying down the law, literally.
Exactly.
And making sure that the punishment fits the crime in a way that is fair and just.
And the second major takeaway revolves around due process. Peeble v. Fuller tells us that delays in prosecution, even if they're within the statutory time limits, can be challenged. If a defendant can show that they were genuinely harmed by the delay, maybe key evidence was lost or witnesses disappeared or their memory faded, then the prosecution could be in real jeopardy.
So it's not just a matter of ticking boxes and meeting deadlines. It's about ensuring that the process itself is fair and doesn't disadvantage the defendant.
Yeah.
What stands out to you about this case in terms of its lasting impact?
Well, Peeble v. Fuller is a reminder that seemingly routine aspects of criminal law, like restitution, can have surprising complexities.
Mm-hmm.
And it highlights how different parts of the legal system, the courts, probation departments, prosecutors, defense attorneys, all have distinct roles to play. And those roles need to be respected.
It's almost like a delicate ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And if one part of the system oversteps its bounds, it can throw everything off balance. For our listeners out there in the legal world, what are some practical takeaways from this case?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, defense attorneys need to be particularly vigilant when it comes to restitution. You need to make sure the judge is the one making the decisions, not the probation department. And if there's been any kind of delay in the case, you need to carefully examine whether that delay might have prejudiced your client's ability to defend themselves.
Don't just assume everything is fine, because it technically falls within some bureaucratic deadline.
Right. Dig deeper, ask questions, and advocate for your client's rights every step of the way.
That's a great point, it seems like. Peeble v. Fuller is a case that every law student and practicing attorney should have on their radar. It's packed with nuances and raises so many important questions about how our justice system operates.
I agree, and it's fascinating how a single case like this can reveal so much about the inner workings of the law. It's also a testament to the power of precedent that this decision from 1982 is still shaping how we handle these issues today.
It really makes you appreciate how law evolves and adapts over time, but also how important it is to have those foundational cases that lay out the ground rules. Before we wrap up, I have one more question that's been bugging me. The court went out of its way to address the restitution issue, even though Fuller never actually objected to it at sentencing. They said it was because the right to a lawful sentence is a fundamental right. But what if she had objected?
That's a really interesting question. It's impossible to say for sure, but it's certainly possible that things could have played out differently.
How so?
Well, if Fuller had raised concerns about the restitution amount during her sentencing, the judge might have addressed them right then and there. It could have prevented the probation department from even having the opportunity to overstep its bounds.
So in a way, this case highlights the importance of being proactive and raising issues as early as possible in the legal process. You never know how a seemingly small objection could potentially change the entire trajectory of a case.
Absolutely. Being an effective advocate means being attentive to every detail and understanding the potential implications of every decision.
This case has been full of twists and turns. It's a stark reminder that even seemingly straightforward legal concepts can have unexpected consequences.
What I find particularly fascinating is how the court in People v. Fuller balanced the need for efficiency with the need to protect individual rights. They acknowledged that allowing probation departments to handle certain aspects of sentencing can streamline the process, but they drew a firm line when it came to core judicial functions like setting the terms of a sentence.
It's a delicate balancing act for sure, but People v. Fuller provides valuable guidance for navigating these complex issues.
Absolutely. It's a case that continues to resonate in legal circles for good reason.
Well, I think we've thoroughly dissected People v. Fuller and extracted all its valuable legal nuggets. Before we wrap up, any final thoughts for our listeners as they delve deeper into the world of restitution and due process?
I think the biggest takeaway is this. Don't take anything for granted in the legal system. Even procedures that seem routine can have hidden depths and far-reaching consequences. And always remember that due process is not just a technicality. It's a cornerstone of our justice system that ensures fairness and protects individual rights.
Yeah, it's fascinating how a case like this, which on the surface might seem like a simple matter of welfare fraud, can unveil such intricate legal principles and spark crucial conversations about the balance between efficiency and individual rights.
Yeah, I think what resonates with me is how People v. Fuller serves as a reminder for all of us in the legal field that even seasoned professionals, we can't afford to become complacent. You know, we need to approach every case, every procedure with a critical eye and a commitment to upholding due process.
It's like that saying, the devil is in the details. You really never know when a seemingly minor procedural issue could have a major impact on the outcome of a case.
Exactly. And for those of you listening who are just starting your journey in the legal world, People v. Fuller offers a valuable lesson in the importance of thoroughness, attention to detail, and a deep understanding of the interplay between different parts of the justice system.
It's a great reminder that the law is a living, breathing thing, constantly evolving and adapting to new situations. And cases like this one provide the building blocks for that evolution. Well, I think we've done a pretty thorough job of unpacking People v. Fuller. Any final words of wisdom for our listeners before we wrap up this deep dive?
Yeah, always remember that the pursuit of justice demands vigilance, a commitment to fairness, and a willingness to challenge assumptions. Never stop questioning, never stop learning, and never underestimate the power of a single case to shape the legal landscape.
Beautifully said. And on that note, we'll wrap up our deep dive into People v. Fuller. We hope you found this exploration insightful and thought-provoking. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp.